Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Please picture me in the trees. I hit my peak at 7.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your valid or nah of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Sunday afternoon, TweetDeck is ablaze. It is ablaze. I want to be honest. You know, we we on podcast, we are all of us, everyone who's here today, all Taylor Swift admirers, fans. That said, it is possible sometimes when a person who has made work that you admire has done something that doesn't sit right. Sometimes that happens. And so Folklore is here, Taylor's eighth album. My review just went live and has been met with Popcast is canceled, John Caramonica is over party. That sounds like I would like to go to that party. TBQH. So we're going to talk about it. We have Karen Gans, Joe Coscarelli, John Pareles. I want to start off just like quick pass the mic roundtable. Let's start with JP. JP, give me a quick terse appraisal on this album.
Who just got a text?
I did, sorry. The text actually reads, I'm not going to say who sent it, but it actually reads, please tell me you're taking the day off the internet. I'm not taking the day off the internet.
You are in a hazmat suit, aren't you, John?
I mean, if you're tweeting at me about being, it's just, that's, don't do that. Love the record. You don't have to hate me at the same time. JP, where you at?
I like this record.
Okay. This is going to be the thing where everybody hangs me out to dry. This is going to be phenomenal. I can't wait.
Don't worry, John. I got your back, John.
Thanks. JP, you think it stands up with her best records?
Yeah, I do, actually. Lover grew on me a lot. Reputation never did. Red is right up there. I think 1989 is singles and filler. And I think this stands up to Red and to Lover. Yes. So take that, you Philistine.
Yeah, I mean, take a number, JP.
but here's the thing. It is a switch away from what she's done. And one of the things we have to worry about as critics is, now that we figured out the last thing, do we want them to keep doing that forever? So I like this tangent that she's taken. I don't think she's going to live here forever. I don't think it destroys the songs the way you seem to. I think she's such a strong identity that it's clearly Taylor Swift. I mean, that's what I wrote about Cardigan was, you know, it's dark and it's complicated. And it's still a Taylor Swift song because she's skipping those syllables like skipping a stone across a pond. I didn't write that.
I'd like to add, I look at my tweet. My ratio right now is 548 comments, 16 retweets, 136 likes. Just throwing that out there. Karen Gans, where you at? I know where you're at. Now you got to tell everybody else.
I know. I've been texting John about this for the past few days. I don't like the album. I don't think it's terrible, but I don't like it. I think there are some beautiful lyrics, and I think there are some beautiful moments of instrumentation, but that does not mean that it's a great album. And JP, I was just meditating on what you just said, and I don't think that my dislike of it is related to not wanting her to change. I think that it's just not serving. For me, there's a couple of things going on. One, I just don't think that the sound is serving all of her melodies in the way that they could be right now. But my main critique is I feel like there's 16 songs and that there are 4 great songs and 2 good songs and a lot of doodles and filler. And that if this were a 10-track album, I think that this would be a really different conversation for me. But I think that there's just too much stuff and that it's obscuring the things that are really, really good. And again, that's not to say that there aren't good moments. This is not a referendum on reviews of the album. But if you were to only read reviews of the album, you would really think that this is the best album that's ever come out. I don't see it that way. And so here's my other big issue, John, and it's actually one tied to the lead of your review about the indie record that's much cooler than mine. And the idea that music that comes in a certain type of package is more real or cool or, you know, whatever. I'm never a fan of when albums telegraph their seriousness to me and announce that they're serious works with signifiers like, you know, woodsy imagery, lowercase titles, or the kind of instrumentation that's seen as more quote unquote authentic. This was it was a central issue at work in A Star Is Born, which JP, you wrote about so well, the supposed dichotomy between Jackson Maine's real rock music and the frothy pop that Ali made. And it was a big part of my problem with Lady Gaga's Joanne. You know, I like to bring up Joanne. Which stripped down to acoustic instruments as a way to convey that the songs were, you know, serious, authentic, important, emotional, raw subject matter. Both Gaga and Taylor have written serious, you know, authentic, important, emotional, raw songs in very different formats than this. And I really don't think any of them, either of them, need the trappings of the idea of a serious album to get there. I keep seeing people saying this is Taylor's most raw or honest work, and it's making me nuts because I find that to be largely a response to the delivery system above everything else. Like, to me, she's made much better, much more personal and raw music. And, you know, critics are just as susceptible to embracing this idea as fans. And okay, that is all I'm going to say about that.
Can I just add one thing to that? And that is sort of a defense of criticism as a practice, right? Because it's been on my mind. You know, we often talk about how quickly we want to turn around reviews of important albums, right? Like a record comes out midnight, Thursday into Friday. When do you want the review of that album to come out? How much time does a critic need to consider it, to absorb it, to take it in, and to think hard about it? And, you know, we generally are trying to step away from quick, instantaneous responses. But one thing that you do see is people at midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., falling over themselves to say, it's a masterpiece, it's a masterpiece. And it's very hard to do any kind of review that quickly, even though obviously some people were provided with copies of the record a little bit in advance. It's hard to do a review that quickly and say anything other than this is great, because this is great is sort of on its face, like, I'm glad this is here. I too am glad this record is here. That doesn't mean I love every song on it. I do think I would love to see more time, more space, more broader assessment. Just throwing that out there. Anyway.
Well, John,
Joe Coscarelli.
Okay. All right. I have like 6 preambles to my own review, but first I want to jump off what you've been saying and have this meta conversation about criticism, which is a plea directly to both John Caramonica and Karen Gans, two people who I love and respect personally and professionally. But I think what I'm going to ask you guys is to continue to live.
You're canceled. I'm deleting your audio.
I want to ask you guys to continue living with this record, because I think you both have really hard jobs here. Like, John, you've now published a thoughtful piece of criticism that is earning you much hate mail, that is instantaneously being funneled almost directly to your brain. Karen, I know you were on vacation. This album disrupted a large part of that. You know, you guys have had a stressful few days. I think this is not an immediate album. I hate instant reviews of anything, good or bad. And I just think, like, you know, let's see where we're all at this record by the end of the year.
Just a memo to all famous people for future years. Do not surprise release albums during Karen's birthday week. That's the gift you can give Karen for her birthday.
I would really appreciate that.
I know they're listening. I know they're all listening.
All of that said, I'm also on vacation, which I think has colored my reception of this album in the opposite way. I am deep in Taylor Swift country. I am on the border of Rhode Island and Massachusetts. When this album came out at midnight, Thursday into Friday, I was sitting on a back porch with a close friend, listening on a laptop while there was a lightning storm with little to no rain happening in the background. I don't know that there is a more perfect scenario with which to receive this album. So everything that I'll say is colored from there.
So you need, there needs to be humidity is what you're saying.
Humidity is great. The next morning, before everyone was awake, I took a drive to the coffee shop with the windows down, the New England sea breeze in my hair. You know, I just like,
you're really flexing Northeastern privilege here.
Joe is in the Harkness house right now.
Look, I'm from the worst parts of Florida. This is not me, but I am here and this album is here with me. But that said, yeah, I think a lot of this is up there with her strongest work. There's a lot of revisionist history that happens with Taylor albums, both good and bad. But
yeah,
I think even an album like Red, which is remembered as like maybe her peak of artistry, it has that. But it also has a lot of what Karen is talking about, which is a flimsy second half and some wayward experiments. I'm going to go ahead and stake my claim on the fact that this album is not as much of a reinvention, I think, as it's being presented or received as. You know, I've already sat here making a playlist of the Taylor songs that I think have led up to this moment, and there's a not insignificant amount of them. And I think, you know, this is a quieter record. It has her not really casting around in sounds that I have always thought fit her badly, and sort of returning to a safer place, both songwriting wise and sonically. And I think, look, this is an album for the Taylor Swift fans whose favorite song on 1989 is Clean, you know, and that's me. So here we are.
And this is for fans of The Archer too.
Yes. Also on my playlist, which I will post once we post this podcast.
Well, maximum solidarity, Joe.
Okay. Let's just set the table. Cause I feel like we've done a lot. We've done a little bit of meta conversation, but we haven't sort of spelled out exactly what's happening. So Taylor's eighth album is a quarantine record. She was recorded in her house in Los Angeles. The production and writing is in collaboration primarily with Aaron Dessner, who is part of The National. The National is a very, very well-regarded, arty indie rock band of the 2000s and 2010s. Happens to be a band that doesn't do a lot for me. That's okay. Try to be open-hearted about this and all things. Jack Antonoff is here a little bit. There is a mystery songwriting collaborator. I'm not interested in that discourse that much. I agree, Joe, with what you're saying, that there are plenty of breadcrumbs that lead to this choice or that lead to these production choices. The thing that I think probably was hardest for me or most frustrating for me is I super enjoy the brightness of Taylor Swift melodies. I enjoy the specificity of the lyrics. I enjoy the structure that she brings. And those things, to me, don't seem to be completely lined up with what Dessner does. Dessner, there seems to be like a low fog that hangs over a lot of the production. And obviously, people can try different things, but to me, it seems to play against the thing that I think Taylor is best at.
What you've loved about Taylor is what you get from hip-hop aesthetics, which is crisp. Which is everything is isolated and stark in its space and separated. I mean, I went back and listened to Lover, and it's like there's so much space on that record. I actually imagine Taylor on this record, on the Jack Antonoff songs, I imagine Antonoff saying, "But Taylor, I can make that drum go boom. Please let me make the drum go boom." And Taylor and Dessner are saying, "No, Jack, muffle it.
We like the drums that go boom."
She switched from a totally crisp aesthetic where her syllables are staccato, her voice is very bright, there's lots of space, to this murky, moody, dare I say, acoustic, even though there's all kinds of tricks in there, aesthetic. There is one song, he pointed out, Mad Woman, that is a total Lana Del Rey song. And that's a different aesthetic. That's an aesthetic of murk and fog and haze. But I think that she's given herself something to fight against in a way. She's writing songs still that battle that. She's built a level of musical ambivalence into the songs that isn't necessarily there in the old Taylor production.
This comes back to something that, if I recall, we said on the Lover podcast, which is no matter what style she's doing, she is such a distinct writer and singer. And that's not from necessarily the power of her voice necessarily, but the way that she decides to flow on a beat or even over a handpicked guitar is so distinct that the background of Taylor Swift's songs to me are always just that. And that's like, you know, when you hear some of the Reputation and Lover songs in the documentary, the Netflix documentary that she made, and you hear her play them on acoustic guitar, they're a different flavor, but the same song. And I think that her little pockets of melody and the little staccato bits and the sharpness, I think, is here. I don't hear this as you describe it in your review, a blurry record. I don't hear it, you know, I think there are vocal effects, there are outfits that there are, you know, clothes that she's trying on, but I think like the body and the bones remain the same. And when people ask for the old Taylor, there's been a lot of that discussion over the last 5 years and three records, I'd say. And I think like what they want is what those people want, myself included, is the storytelling, the specificity. I think this is a total return to form lyrically. She got so vague and so broad in especially on Reputation and 1989, I'd say. And this is just like, I just think like her use of characters back, her use of names and proper nouns is everywhere. There are like 10 classic bridges on this. I think like she's really leaned into her bridge writing, which was always a strength of hers. There are perspective shifts that remind me of her country music, you know, in a third chorus. I think also she's been able to respond to the current events around her for the first time in a way that isn't clumsy and borderline obnoxious.
How do you mean that exactly?
Okay, so for instance, I think a song like My Tears Ricochet, which a lot of people have interpreted to be about, at least in part, her relationship with her former label, Scott Borchetta, Big Machine, the whole Scooter Braun situation. I think that's a very subtle and artful way to go into that. There's lines on there about stolen lullabies and wishing she would stay.
And Clowns in the West.
Exactly. A song like Mirror Ball and This Is Me Trying, about her sort of try hard nature and this idea that she's always trying to please people. These are songs that work on multiple levels. They're love songs. They're about old relationships. They're about new relationships. They're about the past. They're about the future. And they're about the things that she's been through. And I just think they're done more artfully than they have been in the past. To me, I think this album is like fan service in the best way. It's like she listened to what people like that she does, to what got rid of things that they didn't respond to. I think plenty of people see that sort of receptiveness as a negative thing, but I think that's how legacy artists, people on their eighth album, that's how they stay relevant. They're in dialogue with their own mythologies, and they're sort of nipping and tucking things as they go to adjust. So where I saw her being so clumsy, like trying on these different musical styles at parts on recent albums, like this just feels, it just feels like home for her.
It's interesting you talk about interacting with your own mythology, because this is where, you know, we've never explicitly done like a Taylor and Drake cast, but like this is something that Taylor and Drake have quite in common in terms of always folding in the conversation around you into your own conversation about yourself. That's something that she's doing. I agree. She's doing well. You know, it's interesting. You're talking about the return to storytelling. And I went back and I reread my review of the last album, and that thing about vagueness and lack of specificity is something that I talked about then. I'm pretty sure we talked about it on Popcast. That's one of the things that we all love incredibly about Taylor. And I agree. I was really, really excited to see that. In reading the lyric sheet, I felt more emotion from it than in listening to it. Because oftentimes I just didn't feel like I was getting the crispness and the clarity that I want to. You know, Taylor is very, very good at dynamism, understanding how to build up to a really poignant lyric, you know, to a sharp poke. She knows how to create the space that lets something land really hard. And music like this is not spacious. There is no air. It's interesting, you know, Joe, you say you're out kind of in the woods almost, and it feels consonant. But, to me, the claustrophobia of this record really made the emotional moments, like, harder to connect with.
Can we play the bridge here for Mirrorball? I think that's, like, this is both what we're talking about. Like, there's some lines that drop out a little bit, but when she lands the "I've never been a natural" couplet, I think that that is, like, the perfect example of Taylor catharsis and making this sound work for her, but I can see how it wouldn't work for you.
Let's go in. Mirrorball.
When they called off the circus from the disco town, when they sent home the horses and the rodeo clowns, I'm still on that tightrope. I'm still trying everything to get you laughing at me. I'm still a believer, but I don't know why. I've never been a natural. All I do is try, try, try. I'm still on that trapeze. I'm still trying everything to keep you looking at me.
I'm sort of standing in between both of you on one of these issues, which is, like, it's not the sound of the album that I find less appealing. And I don't have as many issues with the production as you do, even though I'm not a giant fan of The National. I agree with what you said about reading the lyric sheet and finding it to be more compelling than perhaps the songs themselves. To me, the songwriting in terms of melody is not there for me. So Joe, I'm very curious about which of the bridges that you love so much. Because for me, when I said that there are four great songs, there are seven, This Is Me Trying, Invisible String, and Betty. And then I think that there are two good songs, which are Mirrorball and Mad Woman, where I kind of like what they're doing more than I actually enjoy listening to the song. But, like, the first six songs, first five songs of the album, I was just so turned off. I just really, they just didn't feel like there was anything to hold on to. But then, but that's just for me, just as the song as a whole, I do think that the lyrics are more powerful when I read them on the page. So my critique is definitely in the middle.
I have to disagree.
I just want to add, we are now at the first faked old tweet part of the Stan attack. Just that's where we're at right now.
Can we convince you to shut your tweet deck for the rest of the episode?
I was like, I don't want you to be suffering through this recording session. Right. Sorry, JP is going to disagree with me. What were you going to say?
I'm disagreeing with you on Last Great American Dynasty because I wasn't looking at a lyric sheet. I was just like, headphones on. And when, you know, she goes through this whole story about Rebecca Harkness being a party girl. But then when she says 50 years is a long time, Holiday House sat quietly on the beach, then it was bought by me. Zing. I mean, that was like, you know, whoa, that's a ripe turn. And she does it quietly and she does it calmly and she does it serenely, but it still zings you.
I'm going to be mean. I think the line that she had a marvelous time ruining everything is amazing. And I felt like the rest of the song was like a writing exercise for a drama class.
Whoa.
It didn't land for me.
And yet you like Betty, which is very similar structurally and in terms of the creative writing aspect.
It's true. I think there's an element to that. But the thing about this album is also that she's writing from a lot of different perspectives, or she says she's writing from a lot of different perspectives, which is interesting. And that's part of what I liked about Betty.
Betty is in one of the more open, airy songs on this album. You know, I think the note that I wrote when I first listened to it was, hey there, Delilah type beat. You know, it has a youthful approachability that signature, you know, it reminds me of Tim McGraw. I mean, I talked about this in the piece a little bit. I didn't get into it too deeply, but there are some melodic choices and some guitar work that reminds me a lot of Tim McGraw, which is Taylor's first single. Maybe it was deliberate. Maybe it was unconscious. I don't know. But it reminds me a lot of that energy. And the difference between Last Great American Dynasty and Betty is Betty does not lose the structure of Taylor's Joy. It does not obscure it. Whereas Last Great American Dynasty feels like it's like something that you're telling someone, but kind of like don't want them to hear. It doesn't feel as forward facing.
Musically for me, Betty has like a vigorousness and a kind of like a continuing energy. And I'm curious to see where it's going to go. And with Last Great, I feel like it sounds like the acoustic version of a song that was actually highly produced. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like this is the stripped down NPR Tiny Desk version of it or something.
Let's listen to a little bit first of Last Great American Dynasty and then of Betty, just to kind of get a little bit of sense from one to the next how they function differently.
Rebecca rode up on the afternoon train. It was sunny. Her salt box house on the coast took a mind off St. Louis. Betty, I won't make assumptions about why you switched your homeroom, but I think it's 'cause of me. Betty, one time I was riding on my skateboard when I passed your house. It's like I couldn't breathe.
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at The New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at The New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to The New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Karen, I agree with you that Last Great American Dynasty sounds like something that could have been on either Lover or even 1989, but I think that boiling it back down to me brings out the storytelling and it lets that perspective shift that Pareles mentioned, lets that really hit. But I do think Betty is a better version of that sort of capital O, capital T, old Taylor. And I think that that's why a lot of people have responded to that song, in addition to her writing allegedly from a male perspective that queers the song a little bit. And, you know, all of that is very interesting. But and that's another track where, you know, you asked about what I thought the great bridges were. I mean, I think the Betty bridge when he finally does show up to the party really has the same suspense as Love Story, which, you know, is maybe her defining song, at least of the first part of her career. And she even draws out that line where, you know, she says he shows up to the door or whatever, and then she says it again and you're like, oh no, what's going to happen? You know,
are they
going to the garden or is she going to get the f*** you? You know, and
in honor of Taylor dropping the F-bomb, we're all dropping F-bombs on Bobcast this week.
Remember how Reputation was the drinking album for Taylor, and we all had to celebrate that, and now we finally got an F-word out of her, and we got it twice, I think.
Twice,
at least, yeah. Another bridge on this that really works for me is Illicit Affairs. I think, like, that has some Dear John in it.
Yes.
For me, don't call me kid, don't call me baby. Look at this idiotic fool that you made me. I mean, like, that's just like classic Taylor Swift. And August is another one. To me, the Taylor songs that have always lasted longest for me are the ones that the motor is her, not the track. And that's what I get most out of this album.
These are all thought exercises, but I do think, and this is something I alluded to about The Last Great American Dynasty, but I do feel like the thing that you are most excited about is also paradoxically the thing that I am most excited about. You know, even something like This Is Me Trying, when I'm looking on paper and even hearing, trying to isolate the melody, I'm into it. I want more of it. And yet somehow I feel like I'm having to clear out my ears or something. You know, it's like there's some buildup in between me and the song.
John, what is your relationship to Wilco's Yankee Hotel Foxtrot?
Minimal.
Okay. Because This Is Me Trying is, you know, it seems to me like a direct allusion to I'm Trying to Break Your Heart, which I think is one of the best songs ever written. This is one of the rare places on the album where I feel like these things, it actually locks in perfectly, the lyrics, the melody, and the production. So I'm wondering, I mean, like, I just want to know if you hated that album in general.
No, I don't know. I mean, of the albums of that kind of category, I feel neutral to positive about that record.
Hmm.
Whereas I should probably just come clean about the National. National is not a band that I have a lot of time or space for historically. They haven't done a lot for me. But in the interest of being open-eared and fair, I went back on Friday and tried to listen to a bunch of old National songs, different albums, different time periods. And I feel like I maybe have a better appreciation of what people hear in the National. But there were moments where they just, the dourness, I think like one thing I wrote down was like Depeche Mode just without the zhuzh. Like there's no kind of like, there's no like.
Is that a technical term?
It is a technical term. It should be if it's not. You know, it really just Ron felt DeVine. Like it was, it's like dictatorial almost. There was like a dictatorial music. And I find that so at odds with the Taylor principle, like the founding Taylor principles. But I did go try, you know, and it's like, you know, I could love the next National album. That's the thing about being a critic. It's like you never quite know where you're going to land. You can end up loving something you didn't like. And I just, it's strange to hear Taylor hearing herself in that music. That I still don't get.
It's very strange. Like, Taylor Swift to me is such a weighty, loaded signifier for people, right? Like, she's one of the most polarizing celebrities and artists of our era, up there with people on her level, Kanye and Drake specifically. Yeah. I'm thinking of like on either side of her. And yet, I think the words The National and Bon Iver carry more weight in these conversations than even Taylor Swift does. Like, I really wonder how this album would have been received without the moody cover, without the production credits before the album. Like,
yes.
If she just dropped this with no information, like, what would people have thought? Like, because to me, you don't even hear Jack Antonoff in this album in the same way that you hear him in her other albums. You know, if totally. You would have asked me, if you would have done a BuzzFeed quiz, which are the Aaron Dessner songs and which are the Jack Antonoff songs, I don't know that I would have gotten it correct. And I have no relationship to the National. I haven't spent much time with their albums since 2007, maybe. I think I know Alligator and Boxer was like their peak. I listened to those albums. I haven't spent much time with anything since. I don't know Aaron Dessner's production history. I know Jack Antonoff's discography very well. And yet, you know, without knowing of the sort of Mazzy Star Violent Femmes brush drums that he added to Lover, and you hear that a lot here. Other than that, I don't hear a ton of his sort of unmistakable quirks in this album.
I think I probably knew This Is Me Trying was an Antonoff song. I don't know. Like I was not reading the credits while I was listening to the record. That song, I think that song and the one after it,
Illicit Affairs.
Yeah, listen.
I remember feeling like there was a slight tonal change in the record at that point. And I think those are Antonoff songs. I don't know if they're the only Antonoff songs, but I think those are Antonoff songs. I just remember felt like, in a weird way, they felt more sympathetic to Taylor. They felt like, I don't know, like the emotions were more foregrounded on those two songs. Or at least that's how I heard it.
I just went back to look at the Lover credits because I was like, the one song on Lover that I felt really most forecasted this was Nice to Have a Friend. And I was like, oh, surely that was an Antonoff song, but it wasn't.
That was a Joel Little doing Antonoff?
No, it was a Frank Dukes
and Lewis doing Bell. Antonoff.
Yeah.
They're all doing Antonoff on that album.
I remember when the three of us listened to the album together for the first time, and you know, I was like, wow, that song was really striking. It was
simpler
sort of like
Simpler times.
Everything about that was a simpler time, but it had a kind of like quirky White Stripes-y quality to it that I really liked, and I was like, okay, I can sort of, you know, connect the dots here.
Should we play a little of This Is Me Trying?
Yes.
Pouring out my heart to a stranger, but I didn't pour the whiskey. I just wanted you to know that this is me trying. I just wanted you to know that this is me trying.
So I have a question for you guys, more for the skeptics in the virtual room, which is during the Lover era, however brief it was, you know, there was no tour, etc., and sort of no lasting hit single from it in terms of radio and that kind of thing. Like, my biggest question was sort of like, what is Taylor Swift's sound moving forward? You know, the next couple years. And I couldn't really come up with an answer, you know? And I think, like, look, maximalist pop, obviously there was some of that on that album. Cruel Summer never even got released as a single. Like, the maximalist pop era, ask Katy Perry, like, it's not going well.
Yeah.
We'll be back in 2 weeks, everyone.
It's quiet. If that Katy Perry album earns a popcast, I'll frankly be very surprised.
You and me both.
But, I'll host it myself. You know, and the sort of 808 stuff that you heard on Reputation, those never really felt like they were going to stick around. Like, obviously, Taylor is not built for like a Dua Lipa, like pop throwback. Like, she's not a belter. She's not a disco star. Like, where did you think she was going to go? And where could you still see her going that wasn't this?
But you know the answer. I mean, this is, look, first of all, shout out to everybody on the Popcast Facebook group. And yes, I put out a call for questions. We'll either get to some of them at the end of this episode, or I might even do a whole other episode. Who even knows? Just for the questions. But there were literally dozens and dozens of, who knows? Who can say? Dozens and dozens of questions. But one of the things that I read, and forgive me because I don't remember who said it, but basically, like, someone said something to the effect of, like, you know, for months or years now on podcasts, John and Joe have been saying Taylor's going to make a Joni Mitchell Blue album. And then someone wrote, I think today or yesterday on the Facebook group, well, you got it and you don't even like it. You know, I guess they wrote it today because the review is out. They're like, huh, what do you make of the fact that she finally did it and you didn't like it? And I guess, you know, to me, I still thought the idea of her making a Joni Mitchell Blue, what that's a stand-in for is basically a complete palate cleanse reset. And this is not a palate cleanse reset. This is a choice to lean in to genre, to lean in to aesthetic. And even Joe, to your point, it's not that you can't find a trail to these choices, because that trail exists to these choices. But this is as much a deliberate zigzag as I think Reputation was. This is deliberate. And part of the reason that I opened the review the way that I did, referring to the line on We Are Never Ever Getting Back Together, was because I think at that point, when Taylor was really stepping into the fullness of her power and of her pop presence, she knew well enough at that point that indie, mopey, whatever, like, that's a fake kind of seriousness. And Taylor is someone who was still clawing to be taken totally seriously by serious people at that stage. And she knew in 2012 that that was bull. So it's weird in 2020 to kind of arrive at a place where that's the genre exercise that she's undertaking.
So you're taking this at face value that this is an indie rock record. Because to me, this is not what indie rock sounds like. I wish indie rock sounded like this.
No. Karen and I were actually kind of having a conversation about this before the piece published, because indie rock is like an unsatisfying term for exactly what this is. It's not indie rock in the Pavement, Matador Records, even Merge Records sense, you know? Obviously, leaning more towards Bon Iver, leaning more towards ambient and ambient folk and country. Indie rock is like a very kind of uncomfortable catch-all. Even when you look at The National, there's like compositional elements in The National that maybe nod to modern classical and things like that. Indie rock's just like a bad phrase.
The National are totally conservatory-ish minimalists. That's what they do. That's all those little parts that you hate on this album that I like. But the other thing is, I mean, this is also a Laurel Canyon album. Exhibit A, August, which is, you know, minimalistic, tangled guitars, very National, but also very Fleetwood Mac and psych folk and Laurel Canyon in the 70s.
Yeah, I'm curious what else you guys hear there, because I think there's a set of references that are very superficial and surface level, which do a lot of work. And then there are the sort of more compositional ones that you're talking about, you know, the National, Bon Iver, you hear a lot of their like smudging on the margins. You know, I hear bits of Lana, like you said, in Mad Woman, and especially in Cardigan, in the hook for Cardigan, which, you know, and I think Taylor's been pretty open about her love for Lana. They share Jack Antonoff in common. You know, I hear bits of Jenny Lewis, especially on the opening song, The One. It reminds me of like when Rilo Kiley sort of flirted with pop. Mazzy Star, The Cranberries, all that stuff. But I'm curious what else you guys are hearing here outside of The National.
I think that Taylor is coming off of a stretch of time where she has made her widest ranging, most pop ambitious music. But it has also coincided with an era where, and this is actually something that was triggered by one of the questions on the Facebook group, she's not getting rewarded for it in the ways that she has been rewarded. She's not getting the Grammys. She's not getting the radio play. And so I do think there is a little bit of deliberate action in saying, well, okay, I might try this other thing, this like taking a critically acclaimed path, working with a critically acclaimed producer. Not that Jack is not critically acclaimed, just in a different way. And even, you know, obviously the Bon Iver duet, judging by everything Dessner was saying, seems like it came about rather organically. But who better to collaborate with than Bon Iver, who's sort of like an unimpeachable avatar of artistic integrity?
Karen, what other references do you hear, though, going back to my other question? I'm curious, like, because to me, there's a lot of stuff in here that would seemingly speak to you.
I know. I'm disappointed. I'm mad I don't like the album more. And trust me, I gave it a ton of time the past few days. I took it to the car, you know, like the hallowed location to listen to music.
Oh, man. I wish I took it to the car. Yeah.
It helped. The one reference I actually did jot down is I had written a couple of places like K Records, 90s stuff. In particular, Mirrorball made me think about the Softies. Do you guys remember the Softies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No.
You don't? Well, maybe we should play a Softies song. We can just play the title track from It's Love, a 1995 album that came out on K Records. I wrote down Wilco more than The National, to be honest. And again, my complaints are, I really don't have that many complaints about the instrumentation. They're more about that they're pretty sketches, but I just don't feel like they're the kind of songs that I like from Taylor.
I think I mentioned there's like a little bit of Enya. I think I wrote down Anthony and the Johnsons on Epiphany. I know this is going to sound maybe very left field, but on Peace, which is a song near the end of the record, which is not like a song I like a lot, I was hearing, strangely, a tiny bit of almost like a Bonnie Raitt blues-adjacent phrasing in how she was expressing her syllables. I think she's trying different things vocally here, you know, and I think that's in response to what space the production leaves for her. Again, not necessarily all the most successful choices, I think, but you want to see her trying different things, so...
I was going to say, vocally, you know, I'm interested in what you guys think of the vocal performances here, but you mentioned Peace, which I think is a really good example of her sort of stretching her boundaries. Like, there's a lot of little melodic pockets on this album, period. There's a lot that call back to previous ones she's used. And then there are some new ones. And Peace, to me, both in where it's placed in the track list and its sort of general mood, is very similar to False God from Lover, which was one of the enduring songs from that album for me. And I, you know, there's a little like Bruce Springsteen in the way she sort of like jumbles syllables together and like overdoes lines. But I just think overall, like that's just it's a song she seems to be feeling really deeply. It's one of the only songs that seems to address her current relationship as opposed to her past one. And I just think that she puts a lot of feeling into it for someone who is not Bonnie Raitt vocally. But, you know, you mentioned that as a parallel. And I think, like, the way she conveys emotion across this record is what keeps me engrossed, even though it's so mid-tempo.
Can I do a shout-out to the production on Peace, which is basically three basses and a pulse?
Yes, Pulse by Justin Vernon.
Yes, that's very National style, is to, you know, do this cyclical, complicated thing. But it also leaves her lots of space, which may be why her emotion rings through so much there.
We should play it.
I like the ingenuity of it. Yeah, let's play Peace.
But I'm a fire and I'll keep your brittle heart warm. If you cascade ocean wave blues come, all these people think love's for show, but I would adapt my own secret. The devil's in the details, but you got a friend in me. Would it be enough if I could never give you peace? Would it be enough if I could never give you peace? Would it be enough? if I could never give you peace.
Okay, so coming off of Peace, which is a song where I'm torn about how successful it is, I sort of feel differently about it each time that I listen to it. At the beginning of Popcast, we played the opening to Seven. And this to me is one of my favorite segments of this record. And I thought it was a great example of Taylor adjusting to the production style at hand, changing her, for lack of a better way, her flow patterns. You see where the rhymes fall. The rhymes fall, you know, on the first syllables of a bar, not on the last syllables. The actual singing has this kind of airiness and lightness to it. It feels both joyful and resigned. And I thought it was a great compromise between what Taylor has always been great at and what these production choices leave space for. That was a moment where I thought, ah, here's a real coming together of two separate ideas into something that holds up.
That song is really enigmatic to me. I mean, what's going on there? She's got this neighbor who is abused. Your dad is always mad. You want to have to cry or hide in the closet. She's in love with this neighbor of unspecified gender. The music is Taylor doing kind of a raga thing, that note that goes up and down. You know, it's a really different kind of melodic line for her because it's smooth. It's not staccato. And this is another song I wrote Lana Del Rey down on, but it's also got a little bit of Madonna with that Madonna turn, with that melodic thing. I don't know. I come back to that song. I think that song's going to have more secrets to show me.
Karen, what do you like about this one?
I really liked it too. Musically and just melodically, I found this the most appealing song. But even just thematically, I like her writing about a sort of like more naive, pre-sexual, pre-pubescent time of her life. It feels like a lot of times the Taylor narrative begins with like love in high school or whatever, middle school. I kind of like this, the simplicity and the imagery in this song. It just felt different. Like I was like, oh, good, there's no dive bar in this song. I really can't take another dive bar reference. I'm just it's an issue for me.
Is this also the song that says they're going to go live in India? Is that?
It is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't like that. I don't know. It just sort of, it has like all these like this weird strings of things that you think when you're a child, and you know, there's really no encumbrances on what you can think or
dream. It's interesting to me that this is the song that has the most consensus among you guys, because to me, the first maybe five times I listened to this album, I could only hear it as a palate cleanser after Mirrorball, which to me is just the masterpiece and knockout of this album, and you know, up there with her best songs of all time, I think. Like, and I was so floored by Mirrorball that like Seven could only really sort of like wash over me as an after effect. But it's really revealed itself to me, I think, like more today as I've been listening to the album. So I'm interested in that. And that sort of makes me hold out hope that you guys are going to come around a little bit more on this album.
What if we're holding out hope that you come around?
Look, I think that's fine too.
Are you one of these people who's dragging me on Twitter, telling me, like, concerned about the Metacritic store?
Yeah,
like,
but as soon as I log off, I'm going to start retweeting John Caramonica is over party tweets.
my God. But have I earned nothing in my 20 years of writing besides John Caramonica's over party?
I just think that Seven is a great song. I do like Mirrorball, Joe, and I will say, listening to you talk about it has upped it from my list of two good songs to the great song. So now I'm tweaking my algorithm to five great songs.
So my work here is done.
Based on what you just said.
The other thing that Seven is doing that I would say at least half of this album does, which I think is just such a perfect subversion, is to make your first, like, quote unquote, mature album, your adult album, about being a kid and about fairy tales that got you here. Like, to me, that's just like, that's such a clever way to flip the narrative of like, oh, now I'm, you know, because she spent these last couple of years making these quote unquote adult albums that didn't feel fully grown. She didn't feel 30. She didn't feel her age. And yet this one does, and she's constantly singing about being a teenager. And there's this little...
We haven't even talked about Invisible Strings.
Yeah. She presented this album as having at least a trilogy about a sort of teenage love triangle written from different perspectives. I think you get a little bit of it on Cardigan, you get some of it on August, and then you get a callback to August on Betty with the get in the car thing. just her diving back into that world that she got so much for living in for so long, this sort of Romeo and Juliet fanfic. And the fact that she's been able to twist that again and do it in this sort of wizened way, like, that to me is the biggest victory of this album.
What did you think, Joe, about the overall idea about writing from different perspectives? Did you find that it was like more freeing? Did you still find that you were trying to attach her autobiography to the songs that were seemingly not about her?
Well, there's been a Popcast and Taylor fan DM'd me something funny, which was to say that these are all songs about her ex-boyfriends pretending to be fairy tales so not to offend her current boyfriend, which I think is really funny and potentially true. I think there's a lot of autobiography in even the broader ones.
Yeah, it felt like a little bit of a rant to say.
But
yeah,
she's always been good at that. A sort of forgotten Taylor song and single, Mine, which does that. You know, obviously Love Story, Our Song, Tim McGraw, like the way she sort of plays around with perspective in those.
I mean, she's just a great storyteller and you know, she has always kind of exploded the idea that you are always singing about yourself, specifically speak. I mean, it's something she's always done.
People we didn't mention who just put out an album produced by Jack Antonoff and have always been very influential to Taylor Swift are the Dixie Chicks. Mm. And I think there's a lot of Dixie Chicks sort of nods on this album.
So, you know, obviously a thing that comes up a lot in the questions that people say is, you know, is this Taylor's, you know, true country record? Is this a step in that direction, et cetera, et cetera? I don't know. I think that was like a question I was maybe more interested in at the time of Lover or Reputation. I don't know if I'm interested in that question, specifically speaking, right now. I feel like if she's going to return to country, she's going to do it on terms much like the Dixie Chicks, you know, even like a Kacey Musgraves. I don't think her country is in dialogue with necessarily the rest of what's happening in country music. And if she ever chooses to do that, you know, I don't think that this is the actual return. I think she nods to it in a couple places, but it's maybe as close as we're going to get. Because I think the pressure around her returning to country is not interesting to her. That's my guess.
Yeah, and why would she return to country? It's so far away from what she's doing now. But storytelling is central to classic country. That's what she's learned from it. That's what she will always take away from it. She's not going to get rid of that. The sound of country is so much like obsolete arena rock now that I don't think it's a place she needs to go. She's done the arenas. You know, if she wants to go inward, which is what this album does. I was also thinking that quarantine is making lots of musicians quieter. You know, we're sitting alone in our apartments, in our lavish home recording studios, no doubt, but you're more or less alone. You're talking to yourself. You're not feeling a giant reaction from a big room full of people or even from your entire band. And that sense of isolation is one reason this album is quieter.
JP, you actually just took the words out of my mouth because I was going to say, I really think we should talk about the quarantine nature of it. I think that's why it's being received the way it is in many ways. I feel like quarantine has softened a lot of people and made them introspective and mushy and, you know, just emotional and receptive to something like this. Just a lot of men, I will say, straight men have been telling me how much they love this album.
Sorry.
No, not present company excluded. And I found, I mean, I think it's interesting because there are a couple of things about that interest me and a couple of things about it that bother me. The thing that bothers me is, you know, people that are like, I never considered listening to Taylor Swift, but, you know, indie rock, she's speaking to me suddenly. Oh, I get it. Wow, she's such a heck of a songwriter. That irks me because Taylor is obviously one of the most talented artists of our generation and an extremely gifted songwriter. And if you weren't
there, you're talking to the wrong people.
Yeah, Cam. That says more about the people who text you.
I'm not revealing anybody's identity, but that's one thing. But the second thing is about that is just like, it's, I think people are just sitting alone or in the woods, perhaps. Far more people I know are in, you know, woodsy, outdoorsy circumstances like you are currently, Joe and JP, than I am. And there is something, there's a quality to this music and to that sound that does sort of draw that in. So I think that she is benefiting from quarantine in that sense. There really is like a quarantine-y quality to this album. You know, like what we were just saying something briefly before about Katy Perry. I like Smile as a song, but it's so out of step with where we are right now. So I think this is, in a way, the right album. I just don't think it's the right songs.
I got a couple questions on the Facebook group about sort of assessing this album, Folklore, up against the Charlie XCX, How I'm Feeling Now, Quar album. These seem to be the two most prominent, completely Quar-born, developed and born albums that have been released. And, you know, I feel like the Charlie record is probably a more effective record on the whole. You know, it's interesting. The number one complaint of people in the podcast Facebook group is that we don't talk about
Charlie. Yeah, I was going to say, they got to you. You just said that a Charlie XCX album is better than a Taylor Swift album. They really got in your head. They've been working the refs so long that you're just calling fouls every time they drive down the lane now.
I believe that's a sporting reference, but I don't know for sure.
Oh, my God.
Plus, John, Charlie XCX is right up your alley. It's like electronic, artificial, crisp sounds. You're allergic to these acoustic instruments.
I'm not. I'm really not. And that's, again, not to harp on Seven, but like Seven, from a pure musical perspective, I thought was the exact right combination of a thing that Taylor does well and a thing that Dessner does well. That's a great thing. But can't all be that.
One of the things that people are responding to with reference to Quarantine is that we haven't gotten a lot of ambitious projects out of Quarantine. We've gotten a lot of tossed off stuff. We've gotten Dark Lane demos. We've gotten these posthumous rap, big rap albums. We've gotten Odds and Ends. We've gotten singles. We've gotten Leftovers. We've gotten deluxe editions, you know, but we haven't gotten fully thought out self-contained projects, with the exception of Charlie XCX. And I think, thinking back to the early days of Quarantine, you know, Fiona Apple, which, you know, was made over many, many years, but sort of had a self-quarantined vibe to it. But outside of those three albums, which I think are all in conversation with one another in various ways, I don't think we've gotten, especially somebody of Taylor's caliber, nobody has put out music from this period like this. And, you know, I'm interested to see sort of what lessons she learns from this. Like, you know, we talk a lot about Taylor responding to critics, to criticism, to fans, you know, to Tumblr, liking posts on Tumblr, her Drake-ness, her like self-reflexiveness. All indications are that this is going to do big numbers. You know, people are sitting at home. I think, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it's has a longer tail than the last two Taylor albums. I wouldn't be surprised if she lands an Album of the Year nomination for it, though I think it's going to be crowded for Dixie Chicks, Fiona, Taylor, that sort of thing. Even someone like Phoebe Bridgers might be knocking at that door in a year like 2020. So I think like quiet female albums are, there are a handful of them this year. But I guess I wonder, like, do you think she's going to take these raves outside of John Caramonica's and think like, I need to go deeper into this world? Or is this just a dalliance? Like, what do you guys think?
Huh?
I think it's a dalliance, but I have no evidence to back that up. I mean, I'm sure that the positive reviews are going to be gratifying, you know, who doesn't want to see their work praised, but this doesn't feel, I think we all agree. It doesn't feel like a landing stop, you know, it feels like a halfway point to something. And I just saying that because I'm being critical of it. Like, even the best songs are fantastic. It feels like she's on her way up a ladder of some sort, or, you know, on a road that she's not there.
I feel like the palate cleanse needs a palate cleanse a little bit, you know? Yeah. And again, not to keep harping, Joe, do you know if it was me or you who said that like future Taylor should be like part Joni, part Shania?
It sounds like maybe you said half and I said half.
Yeah. You know, I think there's probably still a version of that out there, you know, as far as whether this is the Joni move, I don't know that it is. I feel like there is a less varnished, even if it's a different kind of varnish than she usually participates in, if there is a less varnished version of Taylor still out there. And I can see that being something that she moves towards. You know, something that came up a lot in the questions was, how does she tour a record like this? What does a record like this do on radio? How does it fit in the sort of large scale streaming ecosystems? I don't know the answer to that. Like, you know, are any of these songs, you know, for lack of a better framework, are they Z100 songs? Any of them?
No, I don't think so. Taylor's had more success on AAA, you know, adult alternative radio in the last few years.
But are they AAA songs?
They're totally AAA. Oh, yeah.
They're AAA smashes, I think. Adele is shaking.
They're catchier than most of what's on AAA. I mean, that's your secret weapon.
She still has the hook. Someone texted me, a friend of half of the pod, Chris Black, texted me, and he said, "You know, we need your take." And I said, "She's the only person who can make a national song catchy," which I've, you know.
Okay. Five of them.
I don't like that question or that take. I disagree with both.
You know, John, I think you're right that she could go even further down this unvarnished road. Because now when I look back at the map of Taylor's discography, like, okay, so if Red is the halfway point between, you know, country folk and the big pop stuff, and then Reputation is firmly in the pop direction, and then Lover moves back halfway between pop and sort of the folkier singer-songwriter stuff. To me, this is a further step toward singer-songwriterdom. And I could imagine that the blue, whatever, you know, even more stripped down, more piano ballads is still to come, especially if this is received well and white pop is dead on the radio anyway.
Yes, I think instinctually that feels right to me. I do wonder, though, because we've talked a little bit about how the conditions of quarantine have led people to make records that sound a certain way, or to maybe not make records that sound as big or as full. And I wonder if quarantine gets lifted 6 months from now, a year from now, whatever it is, I wonder at that point when you're out there, you're engaged with the possibility of mass joy. Does that then make you say, okay, maybe I want to go back in that direction?
So then she'll make the Dua Lipa.
Becoming more
then
and more.
She makes her Dua Lipa album.
Yes, right.
It'll be a moment of exuberance.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's, I don't know. I think that's a fair question. But that, you know, that probably has as much to do with Taylor Swift as it does with, you know, whether some pharmaceutical company is going to come up with a vaccine sometime in the next 12 months.
I mean, it's interesting that, you know, for as like sort of dour and mid-tempo as this album is, like, the songs that I've had the most trouble getting into are really the most dour ones, the extra sad ones. You know, I'm thinking of, Epiphany and Hoax to me are like weaker points. And even the Bon Iver duet, which, you know, I know you guys want to talk about, like, to me, that song works, but it's too early in the album. It kills the momentum. I would have put it as the second to last track, maybe, but I'm interested to know what you guys feel about the Bunny. I think their voices work really well together. I think it's a beautiful song, if a little Broadway for me, but overall, I just think it comes too early in the record.
That's interesting. I don't feel like it comes too early in the record. I actually, in a weird way, I feel like The Last Great American Dynasty, which immediately precedes it, comes too early in the record. And that,
I agree with both of these things.
The transition from that into Exile is jarring to me. I think Exile is really successful, and it maybe is among the less complicated of the songs on this album, and I'm certainly among the less complicated of the successful songs on this record, but I do think their vocal tones really go together very nicely. I think the last 45 seconds or minute of this song where they're going back and forth is like genuinely bracing. And Exile has a tremendous amount of emotional content.
It's one of the songs on the album that allows multiple readings. I hear it not only as a lover's quarrel, but also as a quarrel with the country. She talks about a homeland. She talks about feeling exiled. There's a political side to it, too. And either way, the argument just gets more and more beautiful.
And I mentioned this earlier that I thought she addressed sort of her own tabloid events and current events in a more artful way on this album. And I think you get that in this song, and you get that in Mad Woman, I think, you know, which you could also see to be about her label situation.
And My Tears Ricochet,
right. And then there's Epiphany, which seems to have at least some allusions to COVID and, you know, this pandemic moment as well.
Whoever on the Facebook group pointed that Mad Woman is likely about Scott and Scooter, or the SBs, as it has been said to me, not the Dunks. Yeah, I mean, like, when I was listening to the lyric, you know, the one that's, it's obvious that Wanting Me Dead has really brought you two together, and then hearing it through that lens, and then, you know, knowing about, like, how intense the rancor was, and I presume still is, in those relationships, that seems like a very, very valid.
My cannons all firing at your yacht.
Woo!
The thing is, though, I mean, she's so much better at it now than she was on Reputation, because she's not just reacting. She's above them. She's like going at them from an Olympian level. She's beyond the conflict to make fun of it.
It's less in the mud and more in the clouds.
I mean, I think that what you're speaking to is a maturity in the songwriting that was always there, but is perhaps like, you know, a little bit more evident. And John, Caramonica, you were saying that you see Exile as an extremely, as a conversation about mature things, about mature disputes.
Yeah, it's a grown-up song. It's a grown folk song, grown folks lyrics. And, you know, to Joe's point about some of the lyrics kind of being very teen referent, you know, whether we're talking about Betty or Invisible String or whatnot, this is Taylor very emphatically saying, you know, I'm approaching, I mean, who knows what middle age is anymore, but like, you know, I can make, if God forbid Taylor
she's
ever
30,
gets to,
John, don't
I'm just,
rush her.
I don't know. I don't know what the numbers are. I'm just saying if she ever, God forbid, gets married and then gets divorced, she'd probably make a hell of a divorce record, but you know, we don't want to wish that
for
on.
Now we have Exile.
Exile, to me, it builds and builds and builds. You know, he gets his say, she gets her say. They argue beautifully. And as you said, John, the last minute is just spectacular.
Let's go out on that song.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, JP. Thanks, Karen. Pray for my ratio and pray for my mentions. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com, or get on the Facebook group and watch the conversation unfold live. You can subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer on a Sunday afternoon, everybody here on a Sunday afternoon, our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back perhaps with Taylor Swift Part 2, who can say, very, very soon. As we go out, here are Justin Vernon and Taylor Swift wrestling each other on Exile.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.